It's 2012 and the rainy season in Sierra Leone. Adama Kamara, 26, is pregnant and in labor. She lives in the jungle, far from any cities, in the central mountainous part of the country. This is her third pregnancy, but she's still childless. Both her previous babies have died. After several days in painful labor, Adama and her husband decide to travel to Masanga, the nearest hospital. It's a long journey over the mountains on a motorbike, but they have no choice.
They find out that they start to bleed or they cannot deliver. Before they are able to go to the hospital, they need to convince their husband or the community. It's possible that they need to collect money from different sources to be able to travel to the hospital. And that process takes time.
Once they arrive, the doctor on call does an ultrasound. Adama's baby is dead. Even worse, the baby is partially outside of Adama's uterus. The only choice is a cesarean section. Any surgery can mean blood loss, but Adama has already lost a lot of blood.
Blood needs to be prepared, and there's not always blood available in the hospital.
In this case, not only was there no blood available, Adama's husband couldn't donate because he was the wrong blood type. And he couldn't call his relatives in their village to get them to come donate because there was no mobile phone coverage. So he got on his motorbike and headed out on the long journey back to the village.
So then again, relatives need to come to the hospital. They need to be screened before a cesarean section can be done. And after all these steps, the bleeding continues and you're running out of time.
The Masanga doctor decides he can't wait until Adama's husband gets back. He has to operate now. It's clear from the ultrasound and the subsequent surgery that the baby inside Adama had been dead for more than a day. Now, the only hope is to save her life. I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you're listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Have you ever felt like the problems facing the planet are so overwhelming? Partly because there is little that we as individuals can do? But what if you could actually do something to address a big problem, like inequities in healthcare? Not just by giving money to the Red Cross or to Doctors Without Borders, even though that's important. But what if you had the skills to help people? And more than just help people, train people so they could help themselves. Today, I'm going to tell you the story of a young doctor who went to Sierra Leone to combat malaria deaths and came back with the realization that maybe he could help this small West African country in a different way. We've all heard the proverb, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day, teach him the fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. In this case, the skill being taught is surgery. Life-saving surgery, like cesarean sections, the surgery that was only available to Adama after she traveled for hours with her husband through the mountains on a motorbike in search of help. Training actual surgeons, though, that can take years. So, the young doctor and a Dutch colleague, who we heard at the top of the podcast, took a different road. To say it's been bumpy would be an understatement. There was a major Ebola outbreak in 2014-2016, just after the program got established. There was resistance from the government, which was afraid that this new type of healthcare provider wouldn't be good enough. There was resistance from Sierra Leone's few doctors, who didn't think anyone other than trained doctors should be performing surgeries. There was the COVID pandemic. And then there are the simple challenges of working in a sub-Saharan country, where everything from traffic accidents to endemic diseases like Lassa fever and malaria can be fatal. This is their story and the story of the people they worked with to bring safe,
life-saving surgery to people like Adama in rural Sierra Leone, community health officers. It's the summer of 2007. The young doctor and his mentor are having coffee in the canteen at St. Olaf's Hospital in Trondheim. Both have worked internationally on medical crises. One, Brynjolf Ystegård, 56, is an experienced surgeon who has spent years volunteering for the Red Cross. The other is
Håkon Borkan. I'm an associate professor of global health at NTNU and a consultant abdominal surgeon at St. Olaf's Hospital.
At the time, Håkon was just 34 and had done some work with international organizations that provide humanitarian medical care. Both Håkon and Brynjolf are committed to using their medical knowledge and skills to help people beyond Norway's borders. But in their conversation, they realize how often the help they provide is related to crises. Medical teams parachute in, help, and then they leave. The long-term pressing medical problems facing lesser developed countries don't disappear, even if the emergency aid provided by the outside doctors has helped save lives. Pandemics and deadly tropical diseases are a huge problem, of course. But what of routine medical procedures, like emergency surgical care, like cesarean sections, for which there will always be a constant need, and without which patients and their babies can die?
I used to work in Sierra Leone. My job then was to create a home-based treatment program for malaria, within a program trying to reduce child death. And we saw that the children that were dying, they had never seen a healthcare facility, so they were dying in their homes. But my passion was in surgery, and we started to reflect, maybe this can be done for surgery also, to train lower-level cadres to do surgery. And then we discovered that this was done actually in East Africa, in quite a few countries. And this gave the inspiration to start a training program in Sierra Leone to train clinical officers to do surgical operations.
A clinical officer, or community health officer, is someone who is trained to diagnose and manage common maternal, child health, and other medical conditions. So there were trained healthcare workers in Sierra Leone already, Håkon knew. Why not give them high-quality surgical training? At the same time, Håkon had met a Danish doctor in Sierra Leone who was working to rehabilitate Masanga, a former leprosy hospital in a remote part of central Sierra Leone. Much of Sierra Leone's healthcare infrastructure was destroyed during the country's civil war, from 1991 to 2002, with Masanga Hospital no exception. But by 2008, international help in the move of a tropical medicine doctor from Holland to Masanga had helped it grow to become a 100-bed hospital. A Norwegian group was also involved with supporting the rebuilding of the hospital. When Håkon reached out, they agreed to support a surgical training initiative. So now the idea had a home. And the surgeons gave their program a name, CapaCare, for building capacity in healthcare. Now, all they needed was money. Fortunately for Håkon, he had a secret weapon.
The first big fundraising event was actually that my wife and me got married. Instead of presents, porcelain and some things, we said that we want help to establish a surgical training program in Sierra Leone. So we had a big wedding, invited a lot of people, and that was the start of our fundraising activity.
That first round of fundraising helped start the funding snowball rolling, so to speak. And by January 2011, Håkon had a new Dutch colleague, Alex van Dunen, who we heard at the top of the podcast. Alex was the doctor who performed the cesarean section on Adama to save her life. Alex was the chief medical officer at Masanga Hospital and agreed to be CapaCare's first coordinator. Together, they enrolled the program's first two students. The training would include 2 years of hands-on work at Masanga and three other district hospitals, followed by a one-year residency at Konant Hospital, the country's main tertiary referral hospital in Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital. In 2012, just 9 months after the program began, I had the chance to meet one of those students, a community health officer named Emmanuel Tommy. Tommy had come to Norway as part of the CapaCare surgical training. Here's what he told me about his decision.
Yeah, it has been very challenging and even to take the decision, because looking at our doctors, they don't want us to do this kind of training. They don't want us to help them in the field of training in saving the lives of our people. So it was difficult. I was even thinking of my future. I have to ask a lot of questions. What is my future if I take up this training? And even my colleagues were skeptical. Man, you see how these people, some of them are very hostile to us. And you want to take up this challenge. This training has never happened. There has been a lot of resistance for them. Now you want to take up this. I say yes. In the first place, I want to be part of people who can write history in this country. It's a sacrifice. I have to take that sacrifice to see. And I believe by taking that sacrifice and the spirit of goodwill and helping my people, I think the future will be bright for me.
As you can hear, Emmanuel and his colleagues had some sense of what lay ahead. Even with Sierra Leone's great need for trained medical personnel, there was a major roadblock, which Emmanuel alluded to: the government. Because as much as the Sierra Leone government recognized that they had an unmet need, government officials had a lot of questions. They worried that the care provided by the community health officers might be substandard because they weren't doctors. So Håkon realized he had to prove that the training was good.
First, we started the program, and then it became clear that, this is actually a big natural experiment that we're doing on a nationwide level. And if we are going to do this in a responsible way, then we need to document properly and we need to evaluate it properly.
Suddenly, Håkon found himself doing a PhD to provide this documentation. What CapaCare is offering is something called task sharing, or, in the words of the World Health Organization, the rational redistribution of tasks among healthcare workforce teams. Specific tasks are moved, where appropriate, from highly qualified health workers to health workers with shorter training and fewer qualifications to make more efficient use of the available human resources for health. In the case of Sierra Leone, there simply aren't enough medical doctors to cover the country's needs. In 2012, right around the time that CapaCare got started, there were only 10 Sierra Leonean surgeons practicing in the hospitals that had been surveyed, or one specialist surgeon for 700,000 people. By comparison, in 2021, the U.S. had one surgeon for every 13,263 people. You don't have to do the math to see that there's a huge discrepancy.
My research was about initially establishing what is the need for surgery in Sierra Leone, what is the unmet need. So we visited all the hospitals in the country, we mapped them out, who were doing every operation theater. We visited all the facilities, hospitals, private clinics. We calculated around 95% of the needed operations was not done in Sierra Leone. So this research was important for that reason. And also to use towards the Ministry of Health, to donors, to others, to say, look, this is the need.
But Håkon's research also showed that for women like Adama,
Women in rural areas, they were had least access to emergency surgical care. And it became obvious that we need to develop things in rural areas. Doctors was not willing, and are still in many countries, they are not willing to go there because you... And somehow you can understand it also. There are poor schools there. There are living conditions are totally different. But still, there is a district hospital there.
During the first 5 years, as he did his research and the trained community health officers joined the workforce, Håkon was also able to document that the nationwide rate of cesarean sections had doubled from 2 to 4% because of the community health officers.
We saw that the increase in the number of cesarean sections performed by clinical officers over a 5 year period increased with more than 1,000%. Within 5 years, they performed between 25 and 30% of the cesarean sections nationwide. And we could also see that all the other groups, the specialists, the medical doctors, they continued as before. So this was an additional cesarean section.
At the same time, Alex, the program director for Kappa Care at Masanga Hospital, decided to follow up on Håkon's research on top of his work at Masanga. As part of his medical training in Holland, Alex had worked in Malawi in East Africa, where task sharing is well established. He had seen how this could help increase the amount of healthcare provided to the country. So he and Håkon wanted clear proof that the community health officer training was working well.
The main question was, is it safe or to let non-doctors perform cesarean sections? And our main outcome was the maternal deaths.
The key thing about Alex's study was that it was a prospective study, where the researchers decide ahead of time which data to include before they collect it. That makes it a really strong study. And in this kind of study, they can determine how much data they need to collect to be able to identify statistically significant results. In this case,
we found out that we needed about 1,200 women to be included in the study. Yeah. So that was a big number of women that needs to be included to be able to give a good answer to this question. But I was ready for the task. So in 2016, I started the data collection together with three research nurses. And at that time, there were 9 hospitals where we had our graduates. So in those hospitals, cesarean sections were done both by medical doctors and by non-medical doctors. And in those 9 hospitals, we were actually able to include more than 1,200 women.
I think it's really hard to appreciate just how difficult this data collection was. Think about Adama's long journey to Masanga Hospital on a motorbike. Sierra Leone's road network is limited and travel can be difficult during the rainy season. The whole eastern half of the country is a wrinkled, crazy quilt of tropical forests and mountains. All in all, it's a pretty amazing accomplishment. Alex did this work with the help of 3 trained nurses.
And we found that in the group that was done by the non-doctors was about one-third, over 400, and there was 1 maternal death in that group. And in the other group, there were about 15 maternal deaths. And there were some differences between the group, but in the end of the day, we can conclude that it is safe and that they are non-inferior, as we call it, to the medical doctors.
It's important to note here that sometimes the doctors might get more complex surgeries because they had more training than the community health officers. In the midst of all this, in 2014, Ebola came to Sierra Leone and the neighboring countries of Guinea and Liberia. You've probably heard of it. It's terrifying and awful. You initially develop a fever and other symptoms, but in the end, you can bleed profusely. About half the people who get the disease die from it. By the time the outbreak was over in June 2016, more than 11,000 people had died and 29,000 people had been infected. But how would that affect the delivery of healthcare in Sierra Leone? Håkon decided to answer this question to document how hospital systems in lesser developed countries respond to epidemics like Ebola. He found that hospital admissions dropped by 50% during the outbreak, presumably because the healthcare system was occupied by addressing the outbreak, as well as patients not really wanting to go to the hospital because of fear of infection. But the volume of C-sections, that didn't drop. The community health officers responded to those women in need. Providing these life-saving services came at a cost to the Kapa Care community, however. First, Joseph Handilo Nageba died from Ebola in August 2014. Samuel Batty died from Ebola in December that same year. They both were infected because they, like many, many, many other healthcare professionals in Sierra Leone and across the globe, continued to help the sick in spite of the risk. Nageba himself wrote on Kapa Care's blog of the stress of working with Ebola as a constant threat. And I quote, "The Ebola epidemic is having a negative impact on my daily life with regards to my work in the wards and the surgeries we perform, because you don't know if the people you're working with have been exposed or not," he wrote. "It's really stressful. The attitude of people towards the Ebola outbreak is negative because most people don't believe there's Ebola. They think health workers are killing their people." And Batty, who came to Norway during the outbreak for additional surgical training in September that year, said, "Healthcare workers have to help in the fight. We have to be cautious not to contract the disease, but we are at war with this disease and we want to do our part. Part of the challenge is that many of these diseases have symptoms that are similar to malaria, fever, aches, and pains." That was the situation in 2019 when tragedy struck again.
Wouter Nollet, he was the program coordinator for Kapa Care during that time. And he was working hard to make sure that the program was going well, ensure the training was going well. But part of working as a program coordinator is to work in the hospital, because that's where the practical training happens. So that's a very important. So there are two important roles within that position. So within the role, he was clinically active, working in the hospital and also doing maternal health care, taking care for pregnant women. And one of the patients that he assisted needed a cesarean section, and he was participating in a surgery. And later on, the patient died. And we found out later that this patient had Lassa fever.
Lassa fever is much like Ebola. It's endemic to Sierra Leone. It's always out there, lurking.
More people got sick, and Wouter, he got so badly sick that he needed to be transported back to the Netherlands. And that was the time we realized that these cases were actually related. And then we found out that this was Lassa fever. And then it was too late and he died in the Netherlands.
The Kapa Care community was devastated by the loss.
Painful in a way that it's difficult to talk about it. And also me personally, being chairing the organization, and did we do enough to make sure that we reduce the risk of this potentially happen? Went through those weeks and our systems over and over again. Also together with his family, and absolutely our darkest times and the most difficult.
Håkon said that the tremendous support from everyone involved in the Kapa Care family helped.
From early on, we are speaking about that we also are a Kapa Care family. We are in this together. Not only us here, but also our trainees and those on the ground. And I think that family thing became very clear in the days before and after his death, that we were such a huge group together. That gave us a lot of comfort and strength, that being able to be together. And we deliberately work very close with people. The capacity building we are doing is capacity within people. And we know every single one of those that we are training, and those that participate in training, they give a lot of themselves. I think if you want to do something important, you want to be close to people, that does not come without the risk of losing someone. And Sierra Leone or West Africa is, at least it's for us, a dangerous place to work in. And it's impossible to have one thing without the other. We have discussed it also, is it worth it? Well, if you think that every human life is worth equally, so this program has definitely saved a lot more life than it has taken.
Now, more than 10 years on, Capacare continues to evolve and change. For one thing, they're opening a branch in Liberia. There, the focus will be a little different.
Liberia is a completely different setting. There's much more focus on training medical doctors and training specialists. And that's why we have been asked by the Ministry of Health to focus on that as well. The project that we're having in Liberia is to support rural rotations for residents in surgery and obstetrics. So we are based in a rural hospital about 6-7 hours from the capital.
And now, having trained more than 80 graduates, the nature of Capacare in Sierra Leone is also changing.
We have been running this project now since 2011, but we're also looking into the future. And we have been asked by the Ministry of Health to merge our program into one of the educational institutions, which is McKinney School of Clinical Sciences under the Ministry of Health. And in that way, it can be more sustainable. So our focus is shifting from only running this program, also to support the school so that in the end of the day, they can run it by themselves.
That may help with a problem that has faced the Capacare graduates since the program first began in 2011.
The legal protection is very weak, and that's
really
a problem.
Yeah.
Because if doing surgery anywhere in the world, and even more so in a country like Sierra Leone, you work with risks all the time, and there's always risk of people dying.
Of course, in the case of surgery, the person may have died anyway. But it can be easy to blame the person who does the surgery. A doctor may have legal protection from prosecution, but the legal situation for the community health officers trained by Capacare remains murky.
If I sleep poorly during the night, it's because of that. Because I feel that we have contributed to created something and actually put people now that on one hand do a great job, very motivated, they go to places where others with the same capacities don't want to go, and they put themselves at an extreme risk. And some of those have been taken to the police. They haven't been a full-blown trial yet, but I'm scared. I'm scared, and they're also in a difficult situation because they can have a boss, usually than a medical doctor, who is on paper more competent, but surgically-wise are less competent.
I managed to interview Emmanuel again after more than a decade. This time we talked digitally using Zoom. When we talked, he was in between patients and preparing to do surgery on a woman who had a very large ovarian cyst. And he's not only doing surgery. Capacare students come to his hospital where he trains them. He agreed with Hoken's assessment of the problem.
The most disheartening thing that will not be recognized officially by the ministry, but they know what we are doing. You know, but we hope that we'll get the government to actually see what we are doing more and then recognize us and place us where we belong on a better pay.
Hoken and Alex think their agreement to merge formally with the McKinney School of Clinical Science may help solve the problem.
Part of the agreement with the Ministry of Health is that the regulatory is one of the things that are spelled out in this agreement. So we use that also as an option to push for regulation, not only for the ones that we have trained, but also for the ones that are trained currently, and those that will be trained in the future as well.
Despite feeling frustrated with the government's inaction on official recognition of the CapaCare graduates and their skills, Emmanuel still feels the satisfaction of being able to make a real difference.
So when I see these babies recovering and them, I see them grown up, you know, I'm very excited. I always reflect, if I was not there to deliver this baby would have died. And that would have been a very big loss to the society, to the community. Perhaps this child is going to grow up to be a very influential person. That child would have lost that opportunity to give back to this country. So I always feel very much satisfied. I feel excited whenever I deliver those babies.
But what if Adama, the woman who needed an emergency C-section while her husband traveled back to their village to recruit blood donors? After the surgery, Adama's condition worsened. Her blood pressure dropped, her heart rate spiked, and she shivered as her temperature spiked. Her husband arrived that evening after the surgery had been performed. Amazingly, he'd been able to find a family member who was able to donate blood. But before the blood was ready, Adama died. The next morning, her husband transported her back to the village on the back of his motorbike. It was the only way he could bring her home. Childbirth is a dangerous thing, no matter where you are in the world. And yet, things are changing in Sierra Leone, in no small part because of the work of the CapaCare's trained community health officers and the new program at the Makani School of Clinical Sciences. Sierra Leone has long been described as the most dangerous place in the world to give birth. But new numbers released by the United Nations program UNICEF in February this year show that deaths in pregnancy and childbirth in Sierra Leone have plunged 74% since 2000. That means that far, far fewer Sierra Leonean women will suffer Adama's terrible fate. I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Our guests on today's show were Håkon Bolken, Alex van Dunen, and Emmanuel Tommy. If you want to know more about CapaCare or to donate to their work, check out their website at capacare.org. And if you want to see some of the academic articles described in this podcast, check out our show notes. Editorial help and sound design by Historia Bruke. Thanks for listening.